So welcome to the meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee. The meeting is called to order. Mrs. Wright, would you please call the roll?
Vice Committee Chair Rita Athus.
Here.
Trustee Dennis Barcima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero.
Here.
Trustee James Innes.
Here.
Trustee Leland Strom.
Here.
Committee Chair Eric Wazowitz.
Here.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Here.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry, would you please confirm that appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. You have a quorum present. An appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
May I have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So made, Strom.
Second, Athus.
Thank you. We have a motion and we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of our previous meeting?
So moved, Herrero.
We have a motion, we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Chair's comments. Matt, have you always had glasses on? You look so professorial there. So it's a good look. It's a good look.
Old age.
Yeah. Come on in. The water's great. So as far as chair's comments are concerned, it seems like all of a sudden research is very important. I know it's not all of a sudden for the people in this room, but it has garnered the attention of the general public. I spent a week at Harvard in the beginning of August, and it was heartbreaking to hear some of the stories that have been, some of the projects that have been stopped due to the cutoff of federal funds, especially in the medical area. Here at NIU, I've always been amazed how many people don't know that we are an R2 university. Richard, you presented at a meeting I was at yesterday with my business forum group, and we discussed the state of research among U.S. academia, and we had input from a business leader that has been very affected by private and public research. So this message has really come more to the forefront. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I think what is going on federally might help us adjust to a new climate of research funding and hopefully become stronger in the long run. I feel this way, and I look forward to our future. And I feel good about it because of our strong management team that we have here at NIU. So with that, I want to welcome any university advisory committee representatives present today. Do you have any comments?
No comments.
Thank you. We recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our parliamentarian, Mr. Perry being our parliamentarian. Have you received any timely requests to address this meeting?
Mr. Chair, once again, we have Mr. Tim Burns, who I do not believe is here for this meeting either. So that's the only one.
Okay. Does he not like us, or does he want to come and show up? Okay. At this point, I'd like to ask Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Richard Mokarski, for news items and comments.
Thank you, and thank you everybody for being here. I'll keep my comments brief. I want to echo what Chair Wasowitz said, which is, I believe our university is positioning itself well to deal with the headwinds. We are tacking through the winds the best we can, and that's because of the agility of our leadership team, but also the agility of our faculty and our students. We continue to have new challenges. Seems like almost daily, normally on a Friday at 4 o'clock, we get new challenges. But with each challenge, instead of panic, it's a, how do we address this in a proactive way? And that has come across in a number of programs that we've launched, which we've discussed in this forum before, but also in things that have happened behind the scenes with some of our processes and some of the fiscal management and partnerships across divisions. I see Ray Earl Jackson here, and he's been a great partner in helping us find funds to help secure the students who are affected by lost funding that has come down. But there are policies as well. that are affecting research in international relations. And I just want to assure the public we are doing everything we can to address those and to position ourselves for anything that comes around the bend. At the end of the day, we believe in the research, artistry, and scholarship of the institution. We know it's a cornerstone of what we do, and it drives the discovery mission, not only of NIU forward, but of the country forward. And we're going to continue to provide the resources that we have and wrangle them as best we can so that our faculty and our students have access to create. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We now move to the university reports. Agenda item 7A, the state legislative report. Ms. Katie Davidson. Katie, where are you? You're here in the virtual world?
I'm in the virtual world.
Probably in Springfield, I would think?
Springfield.
Okay. How was the weather in Springfield today?
Beautiful. It's been beautiful here. So thank you for allowing me to provide a brief update on the report that I submitted. It's in your packet. While conditions have largely been steady since then, there are just a few updates worth mentioning. The Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability's July report shows fiscal year 2026 began with a modest year-over-year decline in revenues. July 2025 revenues came in about $35 million lower than July 2024, driven mainly by decreases in personal and corporate income taxes as well as federal receipts. Those declines were partially offset by increases in several other areas, including an $80 million gain in sales tax, $32 million in estate tax, and $29 million in insurance tax receipts. On the political front, as you are all very well aware, I'm sure, candidates are seeking nominations for the March 2026 primary elections and have begun circulating petitions, which must be filed in late October. Every seat in the House will be on the ballot, along with 39 Senate seats. And that concludes my updates, and I will continue to monitor both the state's fiscal outlook and the upcoming election landscape as they develop, as well as prepare for the October veto session.
Thank you, Katie. Any questions for Katie?
No, just keep up the good work, Katie. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will now move on to the Federal Relations Report. Is Julia Rowe. Julia, you're out in somewhere there.
Good morning, everyone. Joining you virtually from DC. I wanted to start with an update on HR 1, or the reconciliation package that President Trump signed on July 4th. The bill includes many of the administration's priorities and changes to higher education. Of key impact for NIU are changes to the Graduate Plus and Parent Plus loan programs that are now subject to lifetime caps and new accountability measures that ties graduates' median earnings compared to working adults without a degree. The details of these changes and more in HR 1 can be found in my written report. I want to point out that many of the changes in HR 1 will need to go through the rulemaking process and the Department of Education for implementation. Many questions remain about the definitions and some of the timelines as the department begins the rulemaking process. I, along with the university leadership, are working in conjunction with our national associations to find ways to engage the department through this process. The bill also makes other changes in tax law that may impact university foundation and giving, and some changes to existing student loan repayment plans. Looking for FY26, the House and Senate Appropriations Committees have begun to mark up their respective bills to fund the government for fiscal year 26, which begins on October 1st. The bills are mostly not reflective of the President's budget requests that dramatically have cut funding for programs of importance for NIU. However, the House and Senate marks include cuts to programs. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee bill has higher education programs receiving flat funding, which is not the increases that we saw. This does reflect the Senate's positive view of these programs. In July, Congress approved a rescission package set by the White House Office of Management and Budget, which cut funding appropriated in FY26, including cuts to the National Public Radio, and its affiliate programs, of which NIU is one. The joint, which I, indirect costs, I know we talked about this at length in other board meetings, the JAG group has developed a new approach for indirect costs called the FAIR model, which we are testing and working on. Moving to the administration's executive actions, the president has signed over 195 executive orders since taking office in January. Two since our May meeting of particular note, our presidential memorandum titled Ensuring Transparency in Higher Education Admissions, and the department has released, the Department of Education has since released a draft information collection request outlining the data that the department seeks to collect, including application, admissions, scholarship, financial aid, and student data. I'm working with the many sections of campus that report that data and collect it to fully understand the impact for us and working with our associations as they draft comments. The president has also signed executive order titled Improving Oversight of Federal Grant Making, which would require political appointees to sign off on all grants issued by the federal government. Looking at the courts, the Students for FAIR Admissions in the state of Illinois have filed a suit against the Department of Education, alleging that the Hispanic Serving Institution designation is unconstitutional. The Department of Education has said they will not defend the program in courts, and HACU, the organization that represents HSIs, has petitioned to be added as a defendant in the case. A judge has not ruled if they've been added yet. While this works its way through the courts, I want to flag the HSI program is statute and a congressionally mandated program. That concludes my update.
Any questions for Julia?
I think Julia misspoke and said state of Illinois when she meant state of Tennessee, and I just want to correct the record.
Okay. Thank you.
You mentioned something called the JAG group. What does that stand for?
It's the Joint Association Group.
Okay.
That's the group that has been working on the new indirect cost models.
Okay.
Do you want me to speak on the JAG group? Dara's going to get into this a little bit in her presentation as well. It's a group of 14 different associations that are proactively looking at facilities and administration costs and changing the model from what's been in place for roughly 40 years, which is a federally negotiated process that each individual institution does, to a process that is more uniformly applied, and it fundamentally changes the way our budgeting will operate on the back end should it be accepted. They've gone through a series of public forums with constituents like ourselves. In the state of Illinois, we're fortunate. The leader of the JAG group is Calvin Drogemeyer, who is the special assistant to the chancellor of the University of Illinois system, I believe. Former director of OSTP in Washington, D.C., former VP of University of Oklahoma's research division. So we've had some significant face time with them. This would upend a lot of what we do at NIU in terms of how we function for facilities and administration cost. We are running models. We think it could work, but at this point, there's been positive talk that the federal government is mulling this over, but we have yet to see any signed true negotiation from the federal government. So far, it's been a one-sided public conversation. That doesn't mean there's nothing going on in private.
Okay. Thanks for the update. I found that as an interesting name for a group. Any other questions? We're good. Julia, I'm sure the commander's hysteria is in a very high pitch right now, so good luck in D.C.
Thanks.
Have a good one. Let's move on to the agenda item 7C, sponsored program administrative quarterly report. Dara?
Good morning.
Hey, Dara.
Oh, perfect. Glasses will sneak up on you quickly. So. So good morning. Thank you, Chair Wasterwich and the board for the opportunity to present this year's sponsored funding report. We can go to the next slide. All right, so obviously there is a lot going on in the research and the external funding space. So the key topics that I want to be sure to address this morning, first of all, just to give a quick overview of how we did this year with external funding, and then there is quite a bit of information on this year's external funding totals in the written report. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the numbers. I'm just going to provide a little bit more contextual detail behind what you know, what we're seeing this year. But I really want to make time to talk a little bit about the state of play, again, of what we're seeing in research amidst the shifting federal funding environment and the research environment, and what we're doing on the research services side of RIPS to respond to that and to continue to support research, creative activities, and scholarship. All right, next slide. So for fiscal year 2025, we did finish up over last year. We had a total of external funding of $61 million. When we adjust for COVID from fiscal year 2021, we've experienced a 38% increase in that last 5 years in external funding, a 9% increase over last year. We're averaging about 14% annual growth year over year. So there's really nothing unusual about the composition of the funding here that you see in terms of the mix of funding source and program type. I will say that we had a few large awards come in this year that have that contributed to the uptick in putting us at that $61 million. You may recall that last year we had talked about kind of resetting the way that sponsored programs is recording and reporting awards. So we do have that in place now for fiscal year 2026. So based on that new reporting change and given the unpredictability of what's happening with the federal government, it's quite likely that we could, you know, see a decline in what we will be reporting for fiscal year 2026. And just as an example of the new reporting that we're going to be doing and the new way that SPA will be setting up awards, is a project I'm going to talk about a little bit more later on, is this year we received a $3 million three-year award from the National Science Foundation. The National Science Foundation released and gave us that full $3 million up front, and so that full $3 million has been booked and is accounted for in this year's $61 million. Going forward, to have a little bit more internal controls on spending and to smooth out reporting, we would only be including the first year of that award in the report. So that's the change that we're making.
So we have the cash?
We rarely ever have the cash for grants. Grants are mostly always on a cost reimbursement basis. Yeah. So the university incurs the expense and then seeks reimbursement.
Okay, so we don't have the cash.
We don't have the cash. But we are authorized to spend up to a certain amount via a notice of award that we receive, which is a contractual agreement between the university and the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
And again, as has been mentioned, we have seen a slowing of federal awards, so much of what we experienced in funding this year, particularly on the federal side, was primarily in the first half of the fiscal year. Next slide. So this slide is just a breakdown of the composition of external funding across college and division. Again, really nothing unusual here, pretty consistent with what we see year over year. Again, there's information in the written report and a comparison of how the colleges and divisions changed from fiscal year 24 to 25. Next slide. This is just a look at the funding from the last 10 years by program. Again, nothing super unusual here. This is kind of what we expect. A good sign is that you can see that research does continue to tick up, which is positive. Next slide. And this is a look at our portfolio. I'm sorry, I believe that last slide was by sponsor. So a few things I do want to add with that is that this year state funding surpassed federal funding by about $2 million. And since 2015, state grant funding to NIU has increased over 200%. If you may have seen, on the previous slide, the federal funding has trended down a little bit since FY22, and that is likely due to still a peel off of the COVID funds that we had received. But federal funding is still well ahead of where we were, 10 years ago.
And just to note the FY21 number, the spike's always the COVID.
Thank you. Yes, that was COVID. Yep. All right. And by program, again, as I said, nothing, super unusual here for our portfolio. Continue to see an uptick in research. All right, next slide. All right. So I wanted to take a few minutes to, really build, I think, on what Chair Wasowicz had mentioned in his opening remarks about the importance of communicating the value of research and research that's conducted within universities and the important programs that the federal government supports. So we have there's a few news stories here that I think really highlight this well. It highlights the way that grant programs, and particularly federal investment, can both directly benefit our students, but how they also directly benefit our day-to-day lives. Everything from what we pay for our insurance claims to the student support services that our children in K-12 schools receive. I think we've done a really good job within the academy and within our own professional circles of talking about the importance of research and understanding the value of that federal investment. But I do think that we need to talk about it more within our communities. The position that we're in, I think there's a lot of people that don't understand the good work, the important work that happens within universities. And I know people that I associate with outside of work don't understand that research even happens within universities. So I think there's a real opportunity to tell this story. So the first program in the upper left-hand corner is our NSF-funded Belong in STEM program. That is an NSF-funded STEM project, and it's an article that was taken from the Winnebago Chronicle, highlighting NSF's new program that provides scholarships for undergraduate students in STEM. It's a central program of the National Science Foundation, where the agency was founded on the importance of basic research and science education, and recognizing the value of that to our country's competitiveness and national security. The CHIPS and Science Act that was passed a few years ago expanded funding for this program and really challenged NSF to continue investing in the STEM workforce. This grant for us here at NIU is still intact, and we do think that perhaps given the mandate for NSF to support STEM education and STEM workforce may have protected that grant from being canceled. Down below is example of the Department of Education funded Preparing Educators as School Psychologist Program, or PEPS. This is one of the grants that has had future funding canceled. The litigation is pending, and the agency is expected to reopen the program. We don't know what that will mean. The irony here is that Congress created the program that funded this grant after a string of tragic and devastating losses of school shootings. The goal of Congress was to put additional mental health professionals into schools that needed it most, primarily in low-income and rural communities. The problem with that was that there's a shortage of school psychologists to fill those roles. NIU's grant was addressing that shortage. They were retraining teachers who wanted to pivot to become school psychologists and needed flexibility to do that while still keeping their main roles as teachers. Governor Pritzker recently signed into law mandating mental health screenings for K-12 students. And NIU's school psych program is one of the top in the country. This one is particularly near and dear to me. My daughter is just starting her senior year here at NIU, and she is training to be a school psychologist. She selected NIU after talking with Dr. Malecki, and she searched out Dr. Demaret and has been conducting research with her for the last 2 years. So this one hits particularly home for us on a personal level. Up in the right-hand corner is our NSF-funded ICE CHIP project. That is a headline from WGN. It's an $11 million project that NIU is a part of. Our researchers are conducting research along with 100 other researchers to study hail across the U.S. plains and parts of the Rocky Mountains. And I know they were out in the field chasing storms this summer. It's an excellent example of how a research project can be used to connect students to learning and the broader impacts through real-world applications. 15 NIU students have been involved with this project, and it includes an external user group that is comprised of weather and insurance industry experts. Hail is consistently one of the most damaging hazards of thunderstorms, producing losses of over $10 billion a year. So this is a great example of how research and industry can really come together. And then finally, down below is a local NPR story on NIU's partnership with the Morton Arboretum, resulting in a $500 million award. It's more than simply planting trees. It's to improve biodiversity on campus, address climate resilience. It provides training to students, and it will ultimately provide an additional on-campus food source. Funding for this program was part of the Inflation Reduction Act, and we did see that there were many programs funded by that act being canceled. This grant, fortunately, has not been one of them. So I think one of the takeaways here is that what's written into law really does matter, and we're seeing that here. All right, next slide. So to the shifting funding landscape, it has been a challenging time, but I will say that our staff and our faculty have really demonstrated immense resilience over the last 7 months. Resilience is a core value that we have in RIPS, and the staff have without question demonstrated that resilience in a time where the value of their work, the value of their why, in supporting faculty, understanding the importance of the work that they do, and their entire field has felt under attack. And I am immensely proud of all of the staff who have come together to navigate the headwinds that have been upon us and to really rise to the challenge. As has been mentioned, there's been 195 executive orders so far out of this presidency. 57 of those may in some way impact research. We know that 19 for sure directly impact research or grant funding, with the remainder potentially having some adjacent effect to research and grant funding. I just want to highlight a few more takeaways from the executive order that Julia mentioned earlier. One of the more recent ones, improving oversight of federal grant making. Also within that executive order is the need to prioritize funding to institutions that are committed to gold standard science. We're still sorting through what that means, because we believe that focusing on rigor, reproducibility, that those are things that we're already doing. The administration would like to modify the uniform guidance, the federal regulations governing grants, to allow now for termination for convenience. They are calling for specific request and justification for every dollar that we draw in. And this is already happening. So to the question of do we have the cash when we receive an award or a grant, no, we are reimbursed. And so what has been happening now is that federal agencies, DOGE, has required an additional layer of review that has to happen at the agencies before they will make the reimbursement to us for costs already incurred. And that additional information is essentially that we are having to, our post-award staff is having to produce line item justifications to go in and submit to the federal agencies with every drawdown. So that is slowing reimbursements. There's current national metric That's calculating an additional 53,000 hours of effort required now to be reimbursed.
So we're incurring the cost.
We're incurring the cost.
We pay out the money and then we wait for it to come in. So it's really a cash flow.
That is absolutely correct.
An even bigger cash flow burden for us.
That is absolutely correct. And technically by law, under uniform guidance, unless, you know, a payment were to be deemed improper, agencies are expected to reimburse us within 30 days. And so, you know, that is not necessarily happening. And individuals have to certify, our staff certify with every single draw and reimbursement that they request as to the accuracy of that cost. So the systems are already there. This is adding a redundant additional process. That's
Lee, you have a comment?
Yeah, just on this note here, do we track, I'm assuming we do, but track the outstanding reimbursements that are due us?
We do.
And do we know how, what that figure currently is?
I don't have it off the top of my head. We are drawing as frequently as we can to control that cash flow. And again, with our portfolio, we have not experienced, initially last spring, we did experience some what I would consider excessive delays in reimbursement. But so far, staff are just, they're just plugging away and just, you know, getting the justifications in as quickly as possible so as not to avoid a delay. So, yeah. All right. Building on that, SPA has recorded over 30 policy changes and agency notices that has come in the last 7 months. Again, I mean, this is all that idea behind flooding the field. Push as much out as possible. And so just, you know, what's happening on the back end with that is that that takes time to sort out whether or not that policy change applies to us, whether it applies to a subset of awards. We have to find the award that it does apply to. So just working through all those things on the back end and working one-on-one with faculty if their award is potentially impacted to help them understand that and how to move forward. So we've also talked this morning already about the proposed new model for reimbursing universities for overhead cost related to research, which are very real cost. As Richard said, the indirect model has been in place for decades. It's been the foundation of the partnership between the federal government and universities to support research. There was always a recognition of the need for the federal government to fully cover research cost. And that recognition that there's cost to directly conduct the research that you can easily identify, and there's costs like lab safety, keeping the lights on, right, compliance, human resources that also are required, but that are not as easily to identify. And so the model that we've had in place, while not perfect, has generally worked. Every new presidential administration wants to address indirects. That's not new, regardless of the party. That was expected this year. Generally then, there's some hearings in Congress. Everybody talks about it, and we move on. This year, with the flooding of the field, the abrupt changes in agency policies, attempting to immediately limit indirects to 15%, certainly spurred the community to recognize that we needed to quickly respond and have an additional model that could be presented, and that's this group, the JAG group, and what they have been doing. So there's two camps right now, those who think that something will happen, those who think that nothing will happen, depending on the day, depends on what camp we're in. What we are hearing is that the JAG is working with OMB, with the administration and with Congress, and that there is support for this new model. Again, we'll have to see how that plays. We also understand that OMB is working on their own model. We don't know what that looks like. So part of it is to try to race the clock before the lawsuits are settled, because we don't know how they're going to play. So I'm not going to go into the details on what the new model looks like. I'm happy to talk about it, but I won't do that here. But as Richard said, our initial modeling does show that we could come out better, but a big concern across the community is that this means that all of our budget requests would be larger. And so where is that funding going to come from? All right. And as I've mentioned, OMB is working to revise the grant regulations, uniform guidance. Just so that everybody understands, uniform guidance just underwent a complete rewrite 2 years ago. It was the biggest rewrite since it was developed. We have not even implemented all of those changes. And so we don't know what they're planning. We do know they would have to make changes for the indirect model. Certainly if they want to change termination clauses, so we don't know what that's going to look like at this point. The one thing I will say to that with the termination for convenience, I think between that with the rescissions that Julia mentioned, if that continues to be a tool that the administration uses, that it's just going to add to kind of ongoing volatility of grants management. And 4 years ago, or under the previous administration, uniform guidance was modified to adjust the termination language at that time. And we now know this term well. Awards can be terminated when it no longer effectuates the program goals or the agency priorities. And that was a silent change that was made. Advocacy groups did push back and recognize the concern, but the administration was able to get it in, and so we're seeing the impacts of that now. All right, next slide. So looking forward, a few of our goals for the next year, first and foremost is to continue to build out the research services arms of RIPS. That's beginning to really come into focus for us. That is mostly sponsored programs administration and research compliance. It's essentially the administrative and the compliance apparatus that's really necessary to support safe and ethical research and to still make sure that we are good stewards of our sponsored funds. Research administration will continue to increase in complexity. And I will say we don't talk a lot about research compliance, which is probably a good thing, but there has been a lot of change in that space over the last few years, and I don't see that letting up. Particularly in the areas of research security. Looking forward to expanding that partnership with academic affairs and working with AVP Gordon in her role and thinking through how we can balance this administrative and compliance side with support for faculty. The second goal, which is a very exciting one, is our new research intelligence group. We've restructured our current electronic records group, leveraging data analytics expertise that we have within RIPS. We are in the early stages. We're just getting that team settled. But that ultimate goal is to leverage leverage data to support strategic growth and to use it for competitive intelligence. Right now, with everything going on, the focus is to address efficiencies and to help us be more effective in our work. So we're working on a priority list for that, but a few top priority items that have already been identified and that are underway is improving our reporting to the Higher Ed R&D Survey to make sure that we are fully capturing the university's full investment in research. And so that is something that we're working on. We're reworking existing reports, particularly the federal or the faculty grants management reports that they receive out of PeopleSoft to provide more usable information and to get it in the hands of those who need it. And then to create more shared dashboard spaces, again, to provide information reports in a much more usable way for those out in the departments and the colleges who are supporting faculty. And then, of course, continuing to monitor the overhead. Next slide. So joyous is another one of our values in RIPS. So I'm just going to end on a positive note because there's a lot of good things that are really going on behind the scenes. And so up in the left-hand corner, A group of our staff had the opportunity to attend a meeting in Chicago of research administrators, and I just have to say they were so excited to see the importance of their work. And they want to learn, they want to know how they can do their work better. Next to it, every September 25th is Research Administrator Day. It is a real day, if you look on the calendar. And so we get together and we play Research Administration Jeopardy. It's a way for us to learn, and it's a way for us to just come together and to collaborate. Down in the bottom left, we received a grant this year to expand research administration capacity. And so that, we had over 30 people attend an on-campus two-day training intensive, specifically on National Institutes of Health. And so that was staff from sponsored programs, research compliance, and health and human sciences. And then finally, in the bottom right-hand corner, last fall at the meeting in Chicago, which was the Society of Research Administrators, Dr. Walker Ashley, one of our researchers here at NIU, gave the keynote address, and it was phenomenal. People were talking about that keynote for 3 days after, and the NSF program officer came up to me afterwards, and she said, that's the story that people need to hear about research at emerging research institutions. And then last slide. And this is just a picture from a few weeks ago. Heads of different research management organizations across the world, I will say that talking with international colleagues, they're just as concerned about what's happening here. And they're also very supportive of us in the US. And ultimately, I think the tagline just wraps it up best, that research improves your life. So with that, I'm sorry, I had a lot to say this morning. But I'm happy to take questions.
Dara, I'll take quantum computing for 500.
I will have questions? To defer that.
Dennis?
Thank you, Dara, and yourself, Richard. You guys are doing an amazing job in research, despite some strong headwinds, so thank you. I wanted to kind of get back to the cash question. So when we receive a grant, we fund it, and then we submit a voucher or whatever to the organization that gave us the grant, and then they reimburse us for it. You mentioned that I think that there's a requirement to reimburse us within a 30-day window. How often, and I know you don't have that number in front of you, but just off the top of your head, I mean, what percentage of time do we actually get that reimbursement within a 30-day window? And do we find often that what we submit might be rejected? Can you comment on that?
I can. So I don't have hard numbers off the top of my head, but generally speaking, we do receive fairly timely reimbursements. Those vouchers are done multiple ways depending on the agency that we're working with. So the National Science Foundation has their own cash management system. They are really quite good at, we're talking within days of us submitting, you know, for the draw, that we receive that money in the Treasury account. So generally speaking, it's within a matter of days. I'm not aware, and I know that my director would let me know if we had, you know, an issue in really bringing that money in. There was a second point. There was a second question.
Well, I actually have two. One, do we find that our requests or our vouchers are ever rejected? And then my other question was going to be, how good are we at submitting the vouchers on time in a timely fashion?
Yep. We are very good at submitting our vouchers. We do them at least monthly. That's industry standard. However, we have ramped that up given the uncertain environment. And so part of it is that we have to have expenditures posted to the accounts in order to seek reimbursement. So we can't be seeking reimbursements based on estimates. They have to be working their way through the general ledger. But so we have moved to at least twice monthly of, you know, submitting for those draws. We have not traditionally had problems with the reimbursements. Again, my director would let me know if we were. So other than a couple that we did have in the early days this spring, no, I have not heard that we've had any problems. But again, I will say that, you know, staff really have their head down and they are trying to make sure that those justifications right now that they are submitting are as complete as possible to hopefully avoid any bottlenecks.
Thank you.
Montel?
Bear with me as I build this question. I couldn't help but think about, you gave us the 50-some-odd executive orders, those that are going to be impactful to the institutions, those that may be impactful. It begs the question, why? You know, why are we taking this kind of direction nationally to attack certain research institutions? Is this, in your opinion, is this something to manipulate research in the country so we kind of change industries, or is this strictly on a cost savings kind of basis that we're looking at? Can you give us your opinion on that at all?
My opinion. So executive orders are not law, right? So my opinion is that part of issuing the executive orders and at the frequency that the administration has been, I mean, it is part of their game plan that we knew going in to flood the field, right? Just put so much out there that it would be challenging to keep up. I think that some of it is for rhetoric, right? The need to send a messaging to the public. And so for those who, at least in the grant space, it's the world I live in and research, who don't really understand how all of this works behind the scenes, it's easy to read an executive order and believe that there's a lack of transparency in grantsmanship and that there's, you know, this rampant fraud and that by, you know, reviewing payments that's going to get the house in order. But those of us who work in this every day, we know, first of all, there isn't rampant fraud. We know that the systems are in place and we understand what those systems are. So early on, you know, we took the position that we take action when there's actionable action to take. And so we don't change policies, we don't change procedures based on even executive orders or based on the news story of the day. We only act when we have something official from an agency to act on. And that's partly we don't want to do preemptive compliance, right? So I think a lot of it, I mean, they're sending a message. Some of what the administration said they would do is coming through in the executive orders. But I think a lot of it is for rhetoric, my own opinion.
Can I comment? So yep. The curse of being a rhetorician is when the word rhetoric comes up, it's like a bat signal. So I agree with Dara about the idea that some of it's messaging. You can see in the titles what they're saying, transparency, right? It's gold standard, these things. And then you read the executive orders, and there's false claims about the system. So I do want to be crystal clear. The research administration apparatus that we built here and that we built across the country is predicated on robust and significant internal controls. I don't actually think there's a more transparent process through audit, through billing, et cetera, et cetera. Those negotiations for our facilities and administration rates are painful. They age people. They are long, arduous process. And again, we're negotiating with the federal government. We've been doing this since the beginning. So a lot of it is rhetoric. But I think the last executive order, just to speak to that one in particular, was an effort to codify what's already been happening. So we don't have great new data, but the last data we saw was, as a country, we were down over 50% in terms of federal awarding year over year from NSF, NIH, DOD, and I believe it was DOE. That says a whole country, so it's not just us. And that executive order essentially said political appointees need to approve everything. Congress can appropriate. We don't actually have to send it out. So it's both look at the messaging up front as a distraction, but then look underneath. It is to control spending. And so, again, we're going to persist. I did want to mention one other thing quickly. Dara was talking about our goals. I think it's important to note, she mentioned Rachel Gordon, who's over here. We're really excited to have Rachel on our team. She's now, I'm going to read her title because it's long, the Associate Vice President for Global Affairs and Faculty Development. This is a win because Rachel's fantastic. We're really excited to have a sort of soups to nuts viewpoint of faculty development. But it's also exciting because it's a shared position with Provost Ellis Piper. And so this is an opportunity for us to bring the divisions closer together, but also be budget conscious. So wanted to welcome Rachel. We had a chance.
President Freeman, you have something?
Yeah, thank you for giving me a few minutes. I'll be brief, but I hear all of the concerns of the board, and they're the concerns that all of us on campus have. We're concerned about what is happening to the research mission of the university and how political will be affected, not only by flooding the zone with executive orders, but also through further rulemaking, through the budget process, through changes to the uniform guidance. And I think you can tell from Dara's presentation that we are following that very carefully, and we are networked very tightly with the higher education membership organizations, those that represent research. Dara gets to show us those beautiful slides because she is an international leader in research administration with SRA. And so I feel like, you know, we are on top of things, but we're also very cognizant of what we can't control. Our research portfolio is not as large as some of our sister private institutions in this state or the University of Illinois institutions in Chicago at Urbana-Champaign, but we also know that our resilience in terms of the budget runway, the cash on hand, is not as great, and we're also very cognizant of that. And I want to say that what didn't come through, except maybe in the final discussion of Rachel's position, is how our campus has come together to make sure that we preserve our research mission and our faculty and student opportunity and the fiscal stability of the university. We have never had, and I've been here 15 years, never had better communication between the Office of the General Counsel, the Division of Research and Innovation Partnerships, the Division of Academic Affairs, and the colleges. And so, and when I say academic affairs, it's not just the provost's office, it's our chairs, it's our faculty. Everyone understands the very challenging operating environment. And so everyone is trying to make sure that they let us know when they hear something, that they're posting their expenses in a timely fashion, that we're doing what we can control to make sure that we can be the incredible emerging research institution that serves faculty, students, and society. And, you know, you Chair Wasowitz, or, you know, when you and I have known each other for a long time, and I probably can't count on all my fingers and toes all the times you've told me not to waste a crisis. And this is a crisis. And we are not wasting it because our internal infrastructure, not just in RIPS, but across the university, is stronger than it ever has been, because we have to acknowledge how we are all connected and work together to make sure that the most important thing we do, which is educate students and transform their lives, gets done.
Thank you. Awesome. Other thoughts or comments? John.
Just a quick question. I'm trying to understand sort of the mechanics of when support is withheld. So let's just take the program that you talked about, the preparing educators as school psychologists in Northern Illinois. Now, that's a specific program, probably the same as the grant name, and that program funding has been canceled for. But to what extent is the program, is the activity of the program still capable of functioning through the normal operations of the institution and the academic program?
So I'll answer the mechanics question, and I may defer to Richard because I cannot speak to the program itself. Mm-hmm. But what the Department of Education has done with that grant and the way that they've canceled that is it's a five-year award. And Department of Education releases or authorizes us to fund on an annual basis. So there's five budget periods. So I believe in that award we're in year three. So what they've done is they have told us that we will not be receiving funding that is we had planned on to receive for years four and five. So the project directors are having to look to see what impact that is going to have on the students who are currently going through that program, where they're at in terms of their course of study. I think that speaks to some of the work that you're doing, right, to support those situations if
right.
that funding, when that funding goes away.
So the grant itself, I think it's important to note what it does. It's a cohort-based grant where we have roughly eight students a year come through this three-year program. The third year is an internship. These are full-time teachers in high-needs areas. The grant funds their whole experience here at NIU, tuition, stipend, et cetera, and to replace them in the classroom while they're away. That's what the majority of the funding is. In fact, it's probably 80%+ of the funding. We have a little bit of a runway. It ends December 31st. We will do everything we can administratively. We think we have grounds to charge the federal government for their full contract based on the way we interpret guidance. But I am working very closely with Provost Ellis Pfeiffer and other leaders to find ways to bridge this with other funds. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard process, and we're in the middle of it. I'm happy to talk to you offline about it. We don't have anything publicly we can announce, but we are working hard. This one's a little different because it wasn't, oh, it's canceled today. It's canceled December 31st. So we have some time to plan, but it's devastating.
And without getting into the details, the cancellation justification is some element of the program, some part of the mission of the program that is being deemed contrary to the policy efforts of the administration?
In this case, no. The cancellation was very specific. It said, and I'm going to paraphrase, it said, this was a Biden administrative priority. It is not ours.
Okay.
The irony is that the funds were authorized in the first Trump administration for this work. Yes, they were awarded in the Biden administration. But it's the one that we've had that was explicitly called out the Biden presidency.
There's a piece on public radio you can search where the cancellation of the same grant program in a rural Oklahoma school district is covered in detail.
Mm-hmm. Lee?
Appreciate, Dar, the report very much and the urgency and impact that this issue is having on the university. As a member of the Finance Committee with Dennis, I'm still trying to get my head around the financial impact to the university potentially here. For fiscal year 2025, our total awards were around $61 million, is mm-hmm. that correct? Which was actually up from fiscal year 24 mm-hmm. by about $6
million.
Mm-hmm. Of that $61 million, the federal portion, which was $26 million, was down about 8%, about $2.5 million from 24. But the state portion was up $7.5 million. And so what I'm trying to understand, because obviously the large concern here is at the federal level, what might happen yet at the federal level with the impact of all of the changes, what is it looking like for 26 at the federal level? Again, it was down $2.5 million from 24 to 25. Do we have a handle on the dollar amount potential impact into 26 at the federal level? And is the state potentially going to, because the state was up $7.5 million, is that gonna continue at that level? do we anticipate?
Looks like Richard wants to take this.
So there's a little bit of a lot in that question. And I think the first thing I'll say is if you look at the split, it's I think particularly telling. We were awarded $49 million from July 1st to December 31st of last year.
Okay.
So the drop-off is quite a bit larger when you put it in that context, because that puts it at, what, $12 million awarded in the second half of mm-hmm. the year. Part of that is that the state tends to award in the first part of the year. But our federal, we were tracking, I was really looking forward to this meeting because I thought we would be reporting a $90 million year, just to be 100% clear, when it was October, November, because we can see what's in our pipeline and what's being awarded. We still do not understand the ramifications of the federal slowdown, what it's going to be. I will say we have some good idea that the state will continue to actually fund more. We have a large contract that's coming on board this year that will, it's not a research contract, it's a service and education contract, which is great. So we still should see increases in the state, and we'll continue to see a depression of the federal grants.
I want to add something because we are rightfully very concerned and just appropriate to discuss here and you know, going forward, the intersection of federal research funding and fiscal sustainability and operations of the university. And we have always, as a university, been extremely conservative in how we assigned expenses to grants. So in contrast to some of our R1 colleague universities, we have been cautious. We have not assumed that we would always have billions of dollars in indirect or direct costs. And so most of our federal funding has gone to support those research activities or service activities or outreach activities. So losing the funding is certainly devastating because it impacts the student experience, the faculty impact, and our ability to serve the region. But it doesn't leave us with the same level of big holes in our budget because we've been mostly assigning what we got from grants to do the activities attached to those grants specifically.
Thanks. And I just want to also, to your question, Trustee Strom, I think I don't represent the state, but what my understanding too is that while we haven't seen necessarily the state grants go down or decrease, you know, once the federal squeeze impacts the state, and the state may have to make up for things that the federal government won't, you know, may pass on to the states. I just don't think we can expect any growth or the state to pick up any of what we're losing at the federal level. All to say, this further stresses all of the important work that we're doing on the finance side to make sure we're keeping a balanced budget and finding all of the efficiencies that we can find, because there will be no, as much as wonderful as the state and the governor is in protecting higher education and making sure that we have the resources that we need, they're limited, obviously, and they will be even more limited in coming years. So maybe next year we'll still be okay, but I don't know what future years will. It's just my take on all this.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts or discussion? This is probably the most discussion I think we've ever had in a RILA meeting in terms of the board in a public meeting. So, but that's good. That's good stuff. So,
thank you,
Dara. Thank you. On that up note, we will now move to agenda item 7D, faculty presentation. We have with us today Anita Saravanan. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And thank you for coming, and we look forward to your presentation.
Yes, you did pronounce it right.
Okay. When your name's Wazowitz.
Wazowitz Chair.
You never like to screw up last names. So.
Chair Wazowitz. Did I get it right?
That's pretty good.
I take my glasses off. It is an honor.
Matt, you see what you started here with the glasses? It's incredible.
It is an honor and privilege to be here to present my research to the Board of Trustees. So today I'm going to share about what I do here at NIU in the past 5 years, what I've done. And my topic is talking about enhancing older digital health in older adults using technologies, of course, digital technologies. And what I do is use community-based partnership approach. Next slide. Before really going into what I do, first let me share who I am. I've been a nurse for 17 plus years. I've worked in cardiac, surgical, post-op, emergency rooms. I've been a nurse for 12 plus years. I've also worked as a nurse practitioner in pain management and rehab. Next slide. I've also worked in NIH clinical trials. So my research does started, you know, even before I came here. So I was working in patient settings, you know, recruiting pain patients for studies, drawing blood, and more like, you know, bedside work. So when I came here amidst the pandemic during the crisis, so at NIU, amidst the pandemic in 2020, I was lost, just like how we are now. But I think in the past 5 years, I've seen, and I see this continue to be my career paradise. So I'm gonna stop there. What do I mean by a career paradise? In my 35 years, I've not found a place where I could really see my passion and purpose. I'm gonna get emotional, but I knew it. Sorry. I'm a cancer survivor. I didn't think I would break down like this today, but surviving stage 3 cancer. 34 years working, right? 20 years almost as a nurse. This is hard to me, being here, because I touch underserved populations. And that's how I was, you know, from the time I was born. I would always go to the communities. And I would do research, kind of help the communities where I lived, wherever I lived, I would reach them. And I think when I say career paradise, the purpose and passion that I have mirrors with what NIU gives us. So the mission and vision that we have to provide equitable, you know, to give access to reach the communities here is hard to me. I would also like to note here that my sister graduated in 2005 here. So it's a lot of, you know, personal, you know, relationships here. So that's why I say it's a career paradise. So I'm so grateful to be here. I teach across the nursing program. I also teach in the PhD health sciences. I teach, as you see, there are clinicals. You know, I teach assessment. I teach research too. So the next slide. So why it feels like home? You know, when I said the mission and vision mirrors with what I really am passionate about. When I came here, you know, during the crisis, have never worked in a community model, like gone out other than my personal experiences. I was lost here when I came, like, what do I do now? Maybe I'll go into the community, into the retirement homes and try to like teach them about pain management, you know, chronic disease. I'll draw blood, I would do this, you know. I'm gonna like make people learn about self-management. That's what I went, you know, I got my PhD in, you know, nursing sciences. But then when I went there and we listened, I knew and we heard from the older adults that they were left out during the pandemic. There was social isolation, there was lack of access digitally, and when we spoke to them, one of the older adults told me, I'll never forget this, she said, I thought the internet and all the apps will go away one day. Guess what? During the pandemic, we needed it. We didn't have it, and that's what we need. So that's where our journey started. So next slide, please. So we went into the community and we started looking to see what can we do. So this started like right after the pandemic, you know, 2021, 22. And when we heard from the older adults that digital access is their challenge, we took a group of students, you know, and faculty into the retirement homes, you know, around DeKalb. And we try to see their need in detail. So how can we educate them to access and use the, you know, digital technologies? That was the reach. So we got funding, you know, for 3 cycles, small funding. Next slide, please. So what we really found that there is a digital divide, as you know, right? Like when you think of older adults, most of them in the retirement homes are 75 plus. The mean age is like 80 plus. Many of them have flip phones. That was surprising. You go in and you see they flip their phones and you're like, oh, you don't know how to switch it on. You don't know how to switch it off. Can we show how to plug it in? And we really had to like go backward. We thought we were going to show apps when we went there. Guess what? We had to show them how to switch it on, go into the internet. Some places don't have high-speed internet. They do not have high-speed internet in their rooms, especially if you're low-income, low-education, you know, of course, underrepresented groups. You're living in low-income retirement homes. You don't have digital access. So that isolates them further in addition to what happened during the pandemic. So when you talk about digital divide, it's the discrepancy between people who have access and who don't have access. Next slide. So our purpose-driven project, you know, was specifically to address how can we teach older adults to access technology better, especially in our community. So the first time when we went there, we did focus groups, and we found that the older adults, like I said, wanted one step at a time approach, like step by step. They wanted to know, you know, one place where they can go and access like reliable information. They're like, oh, I go on Google. Google doctor tells me go here, go there, but I'm lost. I don't know which one to like look at. Oh, my friend has Parkinson's. How can I help my sister? So those were all like, you know, major themes that came out. So we decided with the student support, we're going to do a handbook for them. We're going to have one website, and we're going to go in and really give workshops and train them step by step. So we call it the Smart Tablet Education for Healthy Living Project, and it's called STEL Project. Next slide, please. So it is a community-based digital literacy program. So STEL is nothing but going into the field, into the community, and like teaching. A little bit on statistics. The 65-plus older population have only 90% times access to internet, meaning internet, not like digital, right? They have only 42% of them have broadband. And then the lack of digital access is about 23 to 29%, all recent. You know, these stats are very recent. And they cannot use the digital health tools, which leads to low digital literacy rates, lack of skills to even like touch the screens and so many other factors, while the population is going to increase by 7%. You know, in the 25 years, our older adult population will increase by 7%. So that's going to be a huge factor compared to the younger, and especially the 75 plus year group, you know. And with the lifespan improving, it's going to be a really big challenge. How do they access telehealth or like use the apps to communicate? And we could see the frustration in the older adults. So next slide, please. So here are some pictures. On the left, you'll see one of our students, you know, providing the handbooks to the older adults that give step-by-step instructions. I did print some here, so I didn't print a lot, but I'm going to pass some for you guys to share. So in the middle, you'll see how we had to like go in. On the right side, you'll see like each one of the older adult was given a tablet, and we had small groups, sessions of eight, and we also did like pre-post workshop, you know, surveys. When we did that, we really saw how impactful this was. Next slide, please. If you see these, you know, these bar graphs, you'll see the blue on the left is the pre-workshop, and the red is the post-workshop. We asked several questions. We picked a few here. On a Likert scale of, you know, 0 to 4, being 4 is strongly agree, what do you think, you know, how are you able to improve your access to internet or looking into the website, things like that. The next slide, please. So participants after the project said that this project was very, you know, effective for them, and they would recommend them to others. They also said that there were very few challenges for them to, they liked the handbook a lot and the website a lot. See, you see most of them really, you know, were engaging, and they really supported the project. Next slide, please. So we're not stopping right here. So this STEL project is a first, you know, few of the many projects we are doing at NIU to really address our mission and vision here to reach the communities. We actually, the last phase, we had stealth facilitators outside NIU participate in the project. We took our students as digital coaches, and we went into other, like, outside Northwest suburbs, like into Cook and, like, DuPage, et cetera. So we've reached more retirement homes. We're also looking at DigiHeart Link as another way to, you know, as another project. We're also looking at a project called Bridge. So these are all digital projects that are really engaging to improve equity. Our hope is that we can make NIU as a hub for aging equity and community-engaged science. So next slide, please. So all this work, you know, when I said this is a career paradise, and all that the work that we continue will continue to do would not have happened without the great leadership here. Dean Fiala, Dr. Gordon, of course, Dr. Makarski have really helped us as a team to really use what we have here at NIU to reach communities. You know, we've been blessed to have many initiatives such as the scholars programs, the SIG groups that we have, more recently the Husky Frontiers, and also the University of Grants Academy, where we're able to sit down as faculty and write grants and submit. So thanks a lot. That I think makes this work very, you know, very, very important and also, you know, rewarding. Next slide, please. So with that said, I want to thank everyone, and I'm open for questions. Thank you.
Any questions?
The magic word that everyone always says, AI. How does AI play a part in all this?
I think that's possibly our next step to move into educating older adults to use AI, because in the second crisis, the most recent second crisis, we all know that older adults are already using ChatGPT. The percentage might be less, but I think we have a moral responsibility to teach them how to use it. And I think this is a project that will evolve into that as well.
Yeah. Well, you've already written a project for it. We're hoping it gets funded. So it's there, and it's a well-wrought project, and that was in the University of Grants Academy, actually.
Yes.
So we're excited about the AI frontier here.
I think half the battle is going to be when people see AI, is it real? Because I look at TikTok now, and I look at my partner, and they say, wait, is that correct? Is that real? You always have to verify things. And I think that's going to be part of the education. You know, don't take everything on face value when you see that.
Yes, yes.
What did you or your...
No, I just have a very quick comment. Thank you for the work that you're doing. You are a great example of why our School of Nursing is so highly ranked. And if I was in the School of Nursing, I would want you as my professor. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that.
Lee?
Yeah, appreciate very much, and the passion you have for this as well. One of the questions, I think, and maybe it gets to dovetails on Montel's concern here, is the senior population is the most heavily targeted for scams and security-related issues. My wife and I were just victims of the most enhanced attack earlier this week that we've ever experienced. It was odd because the attack stemmed from an announcement that family members were expecting their first child, and the scam came as a baby shower invite. So we naturally opened it, and it caused havoc with our computer systems across our family and friends. But my question is, how are you enhancing this again, because this is focused on enhancing health, but how are you integrating security knowledge for seniors to be aware, awareness of potential hazards in there?
That is a great question. Of course, research shows one of the reasons older adults don't want to navigate and use is because of the fear. apprehension and lack of confidence. So the fear is partly because of maybe a previous experience of being spammed. However, if the fear is not addressed, we cannot move forward with access and health. So when we go in and teach how to use these tablets, most of the times with our students, yes, digital champions, they would ask, is it okay I touch here? So the confidence comes when they start using it. So we see this is such a great question. So we see such a divide that there are groups who cannot even go on my chart. The divide is so huge that as we focus on this population who cannot even access, because they call, this is what they say. We call the physician's office, nobody answers. They say, go online, I don't know how to do it. Can you do it? And they get so angry and frustrated, like right in the minute, in the health problem which they are facing right now, they want to contact somebody and they're desperate and they're asking our students or me or our facilitators. When we address this health, as much as we try to talk about security, I have to admit it's a challenge, How can we do everything? It is disappointing that, and again, with limited funding, right? So what we do is we give smart tablets, teach them, and give it for free to for them to keep. But here we have a population who don't even have internet access. They all have I'm still shocked. Like from the retirement rooms, the homes they have to come into the center place where they can have broadband access. That's the reality we're seeing. The disparities. So with AI, when we do it, we have to really teach them first the specifics. And to be honest, will I be spammed tomorrow? Sure. Yeah. Maybe. If I click the wrong thing, and I don't know if we can really fully control that, but I do think that if we can teach them at least to use this for health and then be careful and provide maybe long-term, support. That's what I think is working. We did that for our hearing aid study. We had students go in every week. We had a student go in and they would bring their gadget and they would ask questions. So maybe training that way in the long run might help prevent it, because obviously maybe I'm spammed once in 10 years. They might be spammed every few days and their finances might be fully gone. That's a danger, right? So that's why we have to educate. We can't say, don't use technology, keep the phone away. No, don't use AI, don't use social media. I don't think that's where we are going. We cannot go there. We're already there. How can we say, don't use social media? How can we say, don't use AI? Oh, because one person did suicide, the other person did this, or one person gets spammed. But there are so many benefits and we're already there. How can we educate with what we have and prevent and lessen it when we get the most benefits? That's what I think. I hope I answered.
No, thank you.
We need $500 million.
Well, I don't know. We might have a good on-campus resource in our new cybersecurity program, because cybersecurity is not all about the code. It's also about the human-computer interface. And keeping with the wonderful message you told us about where you would like to see NIU lead, I think there's an interdisciplinary conversation that we can encourage.
That's a great suggestion. Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? I just have one just to add on to what you were talking about with artificial intelligence. So I'm curious, if we're going into this area, are we using our own sandbox then around this?
Yes.
I was on something the other day and I realized I was still logged on to the Harvard site and the prompting was different. So I went to my paid GPT and that was different. So having our own sandbox around this protects.
Yeah, individual, individual accounts, but with changeable passwords that we're going to use.
Yeah.
So it's not the same password every time. To study, at least
but
for...
just staying within our sandbox.
Within NIU and our collaborative, university.
Okay. Thank you.
We have IT people, at the back end who...
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate your passion. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry, I was emotional.
Are there any other matters requiring the attention of the board today? Hearing none, we'll continue on then. The next meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee is November 13, 2025. We'll all be in sweaters. May I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved, Barsema.
Second, Ennis.
We have a motion and a second. Ms. Doyle, will you please call the roll?
Doyle.
I'm sorry. Mrs. You know what? I feel like I'm Ron Burgundy here just reading what's in front of me. So,
Vice Committee Chair Rita Athus.
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Barsema.
Yes.
Trustee John Butler.
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero.
Yes.
Trustee James Innes.
Yes.
Trustee Leland Strum.
Yes.
Committee Chair Eric Wazowitz.
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, the meeting is now adjourned. This concludes the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee. And before I hit the gavel, we're going to take a 5-minute bio break. So please be back here at 10:35. We're adjourned.